On the line, we have Peter Love, who is the president of the Labor History Society, and he's going to be speaking at a public meeting on about Frank Ansley. So we have him on the radio here, you know, to talk about who Frank Ansley was, who was one of the who's known as one of the leaders of the movement against conscription in World War One. Hello, Peter.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good. So I guess our first question is, why don't we start, for the listeners, start from the beginning and tell us, you know, who Peter Ansley was, and then maybe...
Frank.
Frank. Oh, it's Frank. Sorry. I've actually been confusing his name with yours. Yeah, yeah. So Frank Ansley and you know, start from the beginning and then maybe talk about, you know, what his role is as one of the leaders of the of against conscription in World War One.
Okay. Well, of course, Ansley, among other things, that those who know a little bit about him know that he was a remarkably colourful character in the labour movement. He was born in England, actually, and after an itinerant working-class family life, he stowed away to Australia. He worked the coastal trade as first to be a cabin boy and then a seaman, worked on the wharves for a bit. Eventually settled in Melbourne and became part in the 1890s of the growing labour movement, both as a trade unionist and as a political activist, both in labour circles and other socialist circles. He was elected to the seat of East Bourke Boroughs, actually, in 1902, though it's a state seat. And he moved then to the seat of Brunswick for the next election, and then in 1910 joined the federal Parliament for the seat of Bourke. He remained there until 1934. In the course of all those years, he became a prominent left critic of the capitalist system, most particularly the financial services sector, banking, finance, and so on, in the capitalist system. And he developed, in the course of all that, a quite well-known theory of what he called the money power, about the dominant role that finance capital played in the system. But apart from that, he was a particularly vociferous opponent to the Labour government's policy from the beginning of the First World War onwards until it split in 1916. Of the way it conducted the war, its attitude to all things, both military and civilian policies at home. And he became quite a leading figure that the people of Brunswick are rightfully joining along with others like John Curtin and Frank Hyatt and others who came from Brunswick and were leading figures in opposing the 1916 and 1917 campaigns to introduce conscription in Australia.
So, can you tell us more about sort of his campaign against conscription, like in terms of, like, you know, how he built the movement? And
well, he was part of a movement. He was in many ways a front man because he was already a quite prominent publicist, orator, and politician. He was very quick off the mark when war was declared. Actually, he right at the beginning, taking some of the research from left-wing researchers in Europe and Britain before the war and following the Second International's positions, he drew attention to the way in which banks, armament manufacturers, leading social figures and political institutions had enmeshed themselves into a kind of interlocked series of trusts and so on. So it was they who had a dominant role in deciding what would be national policy and what would be things worth fighting for. And of course, he alleged, as along with others, that this is the sort of thing that dragged ordinary working people into war, into the slaughter, to slaughter each other when they had no real cause to fight. At the very beginning, there was all sorts of things he jacked up about. The first one was the government was going to vote money for the relief for Belgium would have been invaded, you know, neutral Belgium. But of course, he pointed out that how would they ever know the money would go to the people who needed it, because the Belgian government was then treating its own people very badly, and its king had been a ruthless exploiter in Africa through the colonial system. When the War Precautions Act was introduced, that was the act which imposed very severe restrictions on what people might say, do, write, and how they might behave during the war years. He opposed that and its restrictive practices bitterly. And he fought against the rising cost of living because Labor had promised earlier on that they'd have a referendum about ability to control prices. But, of course, what happened when the war started, wages were compulsorily pegged using the mechanisms available through the federal government, but also through the arbitration system. But prices just went up because of shortages, and so people were squeezed very badly. And that was one of the issues that women activists were particularly effective in during the course of the war, in drawing attention to that, as well as the horrors of people who've lost members of their family through the hostilities. So he fought alongside a lot of those battling women on that issue, and we sort of stood behind them when they led the way on such matters. He fought over the business about the war and how it was to be financed, and how he alleged that so much of the money that they'd borrowed to fight the war would end up having to be repaid in years to come by those whose families had lost ones, who'd given members of their family to the war, and then they would be expected also to contribute to pay war loans where Australia had gone to fight for Britain, and Britain still required Australia to pay for it. That was something where he touched on some really quite tender nerves with people. He also was part of the trade unions campaign in May 1916, when they started to fear that Billy Hughes, the man who'd become Prime Minister in 1915 when Andy Fisher had retired as Prime Minister, he was the one elected in 1914. And when Hughes took over in 1915, he became a very, very belligerent pro-war Prime Minister, and that alienated a lot of people on the left. And Anstey was one of the small minority to start with who opposed that. But gradually, as the war ground on, you know, he was joined by many others, and eventually the government was very, very divided over a whole lot of issues, of such as cost of living, War Precautions Act, the sort of fate of the war itself, and how well it was effectively being conducted. And so the tensions grew very, very taut, and they had an all-Australian Trade Union Anti-Conscription Congress at Trades Hall in May 1916, where representatives of many of the unions, not all, but many of the unions around Australia came together and declared resolutely against conscription. And So Anstey was one of the leading people who wrote a manifesto that was issued and then subsequently sort of raided. The Trades Hall was raided, as well as the Labor Call newspaper that printed it. And they were confiscated by the military police not long after it was issued. And so he found himself, along with his comrades, in the anti-conscription movement. You know, had direct and bitter loggerheads with the Prime Minister of the day. So, and all this is happening within a Labor government, and so that's what made it particularly sort of fraught in many ways. And so then, when Hughes led 24 of his colleagues out of the caucus room on 14th of November 1916, Labor split. And he set up a different government, eventually with the support of the Liberal opposition. Then Labor, the mainstream Labor, with Anstey's mob and those who were equivocating but were opposed to the war, they were a much diminished party who went across to the opposition benches then. And from there they had to fight through a number of issues. But before the split, they'd fought the campaign, the conscription campaign, tooth and nail, up and down the countryside, and very vigorously. It was interesting in Brunswick because there were a number of loyalist people there too who supported the war, and it became quite a lively sight of the kind of differences that spread right across the country. But Anstey and his colleagues eventually prevailed by a narrow margin in the first vote, whereby it was just a few thousand, but the no campaign won by. It happened again in 1917, towards the end of 1917. There was a Hughes, with his usual trickiness, pulled on another referendum by other means, and he lost again by a larger margin. But by then, things were getting pretty well exhausted, and the war had been dragging on. And there was a lot of bitterness around because of the general war weariness and the damage to the sort of civilian society that so much of those wartime stresses had created. So in many ways, what happened in all of this, in far as Anstey was concerned, was he started as one of the relatively few lone opponents to the war within the Labour Party in the early, at the beginning, but gradually, as times got tough and the government led by Hughes became more belligerent in its pursuit of the war and Labour split, gradually Anstey himself turned even further to the left, disowning the Labour Party because he said it was weak and divided. He became less enamoured of his union comrades. He was president of the Tramways Union at the time. And eventually he put all of his hopes, the future, into his view of what was the people. Essentially a working class, not conceived of in classic Marxian terms, but a kind of populist idea of what the working class was. But when in October 1917 news began to filter through that there'd been a socialist, a revolution in Russia, that socialism was no longer a cause, it was looks like it was going to become a nation state, he got terribly interested in that, saw that this was the future of the world, and this, the uprising of the masses around the world signified a transformative change, and that this would be all that that was required to sweep away the centuries of misery, oppression and bloodshed that had been brought by the wars of competitive capitalist empires.
I just, I guess we only have like a few minutes left, but I just sort of have a, this is more of a question I sort of have, because I know that Frank Anstey is, has his namesake on one of the stations in Brunswick, the Anstey Station,
that's right,
which is what I get off every time I go to work on Monday morning.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to ask, you know, how is sort of Anstey kind of viewed in Australia today, in sort of like, you know, how he's commemorated, and was there like a movement to actually, you know, to get him commemorated in like,
no,
say?
No, not really. I was the only one who actually wrote a full-length biography of him, mostly because it was very difficult to find the material on him. He's regarded, I think, by those who look at Australian history closely, as a particularly colourful and interesting figure in our political history on the Labor side, as representative of a particular radical stream of political thinking in Australian Labor. He is in no way, as well known as some of his young students, his proteges like John Curtin and so on, because Curtin had speaking lessons in Anstey's house in Howard Street, Brunswick, and as did Frank Hyatt and other young up-and-coming Labor blokes. He's not really as widely recognised. But what I think you might reasonably do as you walk into the station on your way to work is, you know, sort of, you know, tap the gate or some such thing and say, you know, morning, Frank, comrade Frank, and sort of hop on the train and off you go.
All right. Well, thanks very much for that informative interview. It was really interesting history, and I would hope that anyone listeners, if they want to find out more about Frank Ansley, Frank Ansley, Peter Love, who's on who we're interviewing now, will be speaking at next Monday at a public meeting. Who was Ansley? And it will be at 6:30 p.m. at the St. Abaros Community Centre, which is at 287 Sydney Road in Brunswick.
Just near the town hall.
Yep, just right near the town hall.
Mm. Right. Well, yep. Okie dokie.
Well, thank you very much for being on our program.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks.
Go well.
Yeah, cheers.
Cheers.